I remember a moment where we said, there are too many customers calling in about problems. And my customer operations director said, we should turn off the phone lines. And I said, you can't turn off the phone lines. We have to speak to them. But it was one of those moments where we were just didn't know what to do because we just had so much traction. And we had to hire a lot of people. So we went from, in the space of 18 months, 40 people to about 300 at a time where we were scaling up the fastest. Probably the worst moment of the journey happened as well. The moments that hurt the most relate to people. But, you know, you have to be prepared to deal with anything as a business.
Leaders are usually good at different stages of the business. Mm-hmm. And often the founder that takes the company from 0 to 100 people might be different from the founder who takes it from 100 people to 1,000 people, which might be different from the person who takes it from 1,000 plus.
It's almost like this competitive challenge, competitive nature in us to say, okay, we're starting a new phase of the business. Are we going to scale or are we not? And in each of those moments, we'll think about. Here we are.
Here we are. That's actually a great way to start. I should start saying that. And here we are. Welcome.
You got to have a trademark.
Okay, yeah, I do. Maybe I should start crowdsourcing that from everyone who comes. I'll be like, give me a catchphrase.
Yeah. I like it. Here we are.
Here we are. So welcome. Here we are. Tell us, what do people need to know about you?
I'm James Grant. I'm the co-founder of My Tutor professionally. Father of two, a boy and a girl, Isla and Henry, personally, and husband to my wife, Talia. I started My Tutor straight out of university with a brief foray into the corporate world at Barclays, and then raised my first money and went full time. So it's been a decade in the edtech space, and it's been an amazing journey, a whirlwind roller coaster, lots of ups and downs, lots of great experiences that I'm sure we're going to dig into. And I guess we're going to cover lots of inside work, outside of work. I love sport, music, and a lot of reading, hiking, that sort of stuff. Yeah. And inside of work, I guess I like the same things, but then with a little bit more structure and intention around the way I deal with people and the mission of making learning accessible to everyone. That's kind of core to our ethos at My Tutor.
Well, you're perfectly suited for this show, so thank you so much for coming. What you missed out from that wonderful intro is something that we both share, is our first foray into entrepreneurship, really, through club nights and DJing. However, I'm going to throw you a curveball of something that you also didn't mention in your intro, which is you used to be a very competitive and high-achieving pole vaulter. And so what lessons have you taken from your time pole vaulting into startups?
Pole vaulting is a risk-taker's sport. And I think one of the things I demonstrated from a very early age is a kind of appetite for risk that I think many entrepreneurs also possess. Pole vaulting came from me being a good runner as a kid and then a teacher at school, the beginning of secondary school, telling me, why don't you give this pole vaulting thing a try? I tried it. I was decent. It built a lot of confidence with it and then realized it was this mad, crazy person sport that required both a mix of kind of speed, power, and technique. The first two I was reasonably good at. The technique part took a little while to come because you end up sort of going upside down over a bar 4 or 5 meters up in the air. In terms of my learnings, I think probably the big early one was discipline and focus, because in pole vault, well, in any sport, you need to put a lot of energy and effort into becoming better. In pole vault, if you don't focus, then you're going to get injured. And I had some pretty rough injuries. Going upside down didn't always work so well for me. Snapped a few poles cut myself in a few different parts of my shoes from just being in these contorted, strange positions. But yeah, focus and discipline was core. And then I think really understanding what elite kind of high performance is. I was really lucky to be spotted early on by a coach who was the national decathlon coach. Decathlon's sort of 10 athletics events. So it's like the ultimate all-rounder event. And he looked at me when I was pole vaulting. I was at Uxbridge University. That was my training spot. And he said to my dad, actually, he said, James has a good physique for decathlon. He's built for like a decathlete. He should come train with our group. And his group was all the national kind of decathletes. It was all the best athletes. And I had my first experience of being the worst person in a really elite group, which is amazing. And it taught me that you should always seek to be the worst person in the room, the dumbest person in the room, the least skillful person in the room, because you are going to be brought up by that group. So I trained with all these elite athletes and was embarrassed pretty much every session. But they were older than me. And actually, when I ended up competing back against people of my age, I did pretty well because I'd come from that grounding of, wow, there are so many people out here who are better than me and I can learn from them and I can be pushed by them. So that was probably the biggest learning.
So then, speaking of being the worst in the room, let's say being the dumbest in the room, if you pull it into the startup sense, you, my tutor, have done an amazing job of hiring very senior people. Mm-hmm. And so can you talk about how you were able to achieve that? Because it's not a small feat to convince someone who's very senior and experienced to come to a small startup.
Yeah, my co-founder Bertie and I, from very early on, had to learn how to hire people who would never have normally considered us a year or two before. And so the first thing that you have to have is a really compelling story. Stories matter because great people want to see ambition, they want to see impact, and they want to understand how you're going to get there or your vision of how you're going to get there. They also want to understand the culture you've built and how you've evolved as a leader. And so I think being able to really package up the story of where you're going, why you need them on the journey is exceptionally important. I would also say having a very structured hiring process, because early on when we were a bit more gung-ho, less well put together, we'd just do a couple of interviews and get loads of people in the room to meet this person. And then every interview had different questions. It was really difficult to compare. People didn't really know what you were hiring against. So having a really high quality hiring scorecard is really essential. Having a process where in each stage you have two people in the interview, I found really beneficial, because then you have one person who's asking the questions and the other person who's listening to the answer and really observing the candidate. I also think the quality of the follow-up and the touching base throughout the process is something that sounds really basic and unexciting, but it's so critical, because people go cold very, very quickly if you don't constantly touch base, give them feedback each stage, and a respect that they're investing a lot in the process. And so you owe them feedback, you owe them responses, you owe them clarity on when you're going to make decisions. So yeah, I think communicating the story well, understanding what you're hiring and why, what a good response or candidate experience would look like, and then having a really good structure around the interview process that's consistent and communicative.
Can we go into the details of the structure around the interview process?
Sure.
What does that look like?
Everyone looks slightly different, but I suppose the consistent themes would be you want probably for a C-level hire, something like five stages. So stage one would be a screening call with the recruiter, which could be internal or could be an external recruiter. Stage two would be the hiring manager call. So whoever's leading the hire and going to be managing the person wants to do an initial competency-based interview that might also include a bit of the story, so buying in the candidate. Then next stage would be competency. So normally it would be a couple of like cross-functional colleagues, probably either similar level or level above, who are asking questions to see if the person has the skill set and the acumen and the right experiences to be a fit. Then a case study round, which would be normally an applicable, either a case study of some work that they've done in their career that's really relevant to the role, or something around a presentation of a problem that you're trying to solve this role would help with. And then you have culture fit, or culture add, we call it, where you're trying to understand, are they values aligned, but also what would they add to your company that you don't already have? Then we often do like a board kind of sense check to make sure that we've made the right decision and to check any blind spots. So that's the actual interview process itself. There's obviously bits beforehand to set up to make sure that you're running a really slick process and make sure you know exactly what you're hiring for.
You said that a couple of times. To me, the immediate thing is just a clear job description. Is it more than that?
Job description is super helpful. I would say I would go beyond that. So I would look at normally the characteristics that you're looking for and the experiences. I would then think about the questions that you're looking to ask during the process that map to those, and then the person in the process that is responsible for that, because you want the same person judging the same thing each time. So you want to be really clear on what role everyone has to play in the process, because in a 45-minute conversation, you're never going to be able to cover everything. And so when you're wrapping up and you're coming together saying, like, what does everyone think? Are we going to hire this person? You're not just going for a gut feel. You're asking them to compare candidates, the way they've answered certain questions. You just want to be relatively scientific about it. Mm. And then at the end, you can still do the gut-based kind of, what's my intuition here?
Yeah.
Because that's really important. But you also have a very thorough and consistent process so that you can avoid any mistakes. The bit I haven't mentioned is the referencing, which to me is actually potentially the most important bit, because speaking to people who have been either managed by the person, or a combination of managed by the person, a colleague of the person, and the manager of the person, you will find out so much just by asking them questions that aren't like, is this person good or not? It's more around, how can I support this person? What makes this person frustrated? What sort of examples have you seen of these behaviors? And then you can get the kind of real honest view, because you're not putting a person in a position where they're worried that they're going to stop a person from getting a role. You're just saying, like, how can I support this person?
And then the check-in process as well. What's the cadence of that at each stage?
Before and after every interview, you want to set the scene of what the interview is going to be, talk about who they're meeting. And normally this would be a recruiter or recruitment manager within the company, talent partner. And then after the session, you want to collect feedback from the interviewers, give the candidate a sense of, you know, this is what went well, this is what went less well, and talk about the next steps. And sometimes we add steps if we've got an area of uncertainty that we want to dig into, and we create some sort of bespoke method of finding out. I think it's just as much as possible, because the candidate then feels like they've got engagement, that if they put in effort, it will be rewarded, even if it doesn't work out. And just being respectful in general, because it sets a real tone of how the company brand is perceived externally.
It all makes sense, and it's all very well and good when you have the resources to focus on this level of depth in a hiring process, like having your recruitment manager. You only hire someone in that role once you're either about to scale up massively, or like you're already at however many people. What are the different sizes of company that naturally leads this level of process?
Well, so there's a lot of processes that do come as a company grows. So whether it's your people policies or your benefits, or just the automation around the contracting process, the referencing process. But everything I've just said is for a company of any stage, because you can substitute the recruitment manager that you don't have for yourself. In the early days, the people you bring on are the most important thing, and your business will not succeed if you mishire, regardless of whether you're great, you've got the right strategy, you've got the right funding. So it's somewhere to invest, and it is an investment hiring someone. So especially if you're hiring a leadership team member, getting it wrong is so much more time consuming than spending the time getting it right. So much more and really stressful. And you will get it wrong anyway. Even if you do all these things, you'll get it wrong. I've got it wrong loads of times. But the idea is you get it right more than you get it wrong. And you get better over time, even though you'll never have a perfect track record. Mm. So I would say just substitute a recruitment manager for yourself in the early stages, and it's time well spent.
Oh, God, it rings so true for me as well. It's something I haven't invested in the past. I've always been like very, there's a problem that's urgent and it needs fixing and I need help with it now. And so I'll just quickly scramble around to find someone and pull them in. But now having run founders and spoken to lots of people with bigger teams as well, it is just so clear and apparent that it's one of those processes that's so highly leveraged. If you get the right people in, then it just can really accelerate the business.
Yeah, for sure.
One of the failures that you've made in recruiting, can you share a failure story?
There are lots of failure stories. I think one that I remember, which is actually nothing to do with the person, was we were hiring our first salesperson within our B2B business, which is basically selling tutoring to schools. And my theory at the time was schools are not commercial beasts. Teachers in schools are not commercial beasts. And so they need a certain type of sell that's not, it's different from like software sales. It's a bit more of a consultative, long-term relationship building, which I guess is consistent, but teachers don't like the feeling of being sold to. So my theory
is like educative as well, where you have to explain that there's a problem and that this would help with the problem, or is it
potentially, but in education speak. Yeah. So my theory was if you found an ex-teacher who is really good at communicating, because teachers are good at communicating generally, then you can train up the sales bit afterwards. And this is super early on. I hired someone who's super smart, is super smart, and she got going really quickly. But me managing her, when I hadn't really done proper sales, I hadn't scaled up a sales team, I wasn't able really to give her a lot of the sales acumen and process that she probably needed and structure that she needed. And I remember her winning her first deal, and it was a really good deal. We were really happy. And she said, "I feel nothing, actually." And I, at that point, I realized that sales was totally wrong for her. It was the total wrong role. She'd gone in from teaching thinking, "I want to get in a startup. Sales seems like the right place to be," but it wasn't. And so I made a couple of mistakes. One is that even though I may have been right about some of the teacher side of it being a good sort of person to sell to other teachers, doing that without the sales manager with proper sales structure was a mistake. Mm-hmm. Another mistake was not taking the time to understand the motivations of this person. And they didn't actually want to be in sales. They enjoyed startups. They were interested in entrepreneurship. They were really passionate about education, which are three ticks, but sales wasn't going to be the right role within that sphere. And so it didn't work out, and it was the right decision for both parties to part ways. And I learned a couple of lessons.
And there wasn't like a refocusing of them in the business, a different role?
At the time, there probably could have been. And there are loads of examples where we have done that. In this particular case, I think she wanted to move into a slightly different world. And so, yeah, not in this case, but it can definitely happen where someone doesn't feel the role fit and we find space for them elsewhere.
Which leads us perfectly into how do you nurture people within the business? You mentioned earlier that you've had a lot of young people starting and you've taken them on this progressive journey into quite senior roles.
How you nurture people is different at different stages. So I care a lot about bringing people up from within the company. I love loyal people who back the mission, who stick with us through thick and thin. And therefore, in my career, I think I've had almost a bias towards over-investing in those people at the expense of having that balance, because you do want a balance of people who are coming up through the organization. Perhaps it's the only context they've seen, and then more experienced people who've seen lots of different contexts. It has to be a balance. In terms of the best way to nurture the people who've come from within, I think there's a few lessons I've learned. One is to spend dedicated time outside of your normal one-to-one structure, perhaps monthly, to really understand what sort of things matter to them. And you have to push past the common answers because everyone says the same thing. Well, not everyone, but there's a lot of themes. One is, I want to become more data literate. I want to become a manager. I want to end up as a business leader. And they say generic things like that. And then you've got to break down the difference between what society is telling them they should say and what they actually care about. So it takes a lot of like digging, asking the question a few times, reframing it, because I found that people think that they want to be a manager sometimes, and then actually it's the worst thing they've ever done. They were really happy being an individual contributor, and that is a totally legitimate path for them. So yeah, one thing is really listening and building the ring fence space each month to follow up and see how it's evolving. The second thing I think is network and community. So any in areas of interest, it's great if you internally have the systems to help them progress, but you also want them to get the outside context. So finding mentors for them. And I think you as a manager can really help facilitate that. The third, I would say, is giving people ownership of things and giving them almost problems to solve and trusting them with them. There's a delicate balance here because I think particularly more junior employees, you need to give them guardrails and structure. So it's not just a case of, oh, here's the thing, go fix it, because that's actually quite disempowering sometimes because they'll feel stuck and not know what to do. It's more saying like, here's a problem. Here are some things that within that problem I care about and think we should use as a lens for solving the problem. And then give them space for creativity around it. And then you can teach skills around that, like project management skills. It could be analytical skills. We early on at My Tutor had this weekly MySQL training to help people become data literate. And then we'd have tests each week, like fun tests, where it was like competitions. And through that, rather than hiring a massive data team, half of our company were completely literate in how to run their own queries and analyze performance. And so those sorts of nuggets really help build a culture of learning. And we are a learning company. So, yeah.
Very on brand. That's incredible. It feels like the leaning towards nurturing people internally is a lot more just like cost effective as well, right? Than trying to create a whole hiring process and spend a lot of time doing that as opposed to like investing in people you already know are value aligned, you already have trust with, you already know how to communicate with, they already understand the company. There's no time lag with when they're going to start being effective, or at least it's a lot less than when a newcomer joins. So it sounds like a very healthy approach.
It is. It's all about the balance because, yes, it's cost effective promoting someone internally and backing them and supporting them. But also you should spend to invest in them. There's training, there's mentoring, and that does cost. So I don't think it should just be seen. I know you're not saying that, but it shouldn't be seen through the lens of just cost efficiency.
Yeah.
The reality is you've got people, particularly those early on in the business, who are evangelical about it. They care so much, and it's really hard to find later on. So that you can find passionate people who care about your business later on as you grow, but you're not going to find people with the same level of ownership and care as those founding members. And so that's one of the reasons I really care about them carrying forward the DNA, the culture. And then if you have the right balance, and so for example, there's no science around it, but if you have a mix of very experienced people who you've brought in over time and people who've come up through the company, you'll have an amazing diverse culture. And you'll take the best from both worlds, the business context, the young enthusiasm, the passion for the mission, and the willingness to learn and be coached. And then the people who can say, you know what, I've seen this problem before. This is how we dealt with it at this place. This is how we dealt with it at that place. The kind of fusing of those two types of people are exactly what you need.
Really love that comment that you said, that it's a lot more difficult to find people that are super passionate about it later on, as in the how I understood that was when the business grows to a certain size, like now you're at 300 people, it's a lot more difficult to bring in new people and then be as enthusiastic about it. Is that right?
It's not just enthusiasm necessarily, it's treating it with the same level of ownership. So if you feel like a founding employee, you have a different sort of mentality. Yeah. And it's not to say that you can't find it later on, But, you know, these people may have been given some ownership in the company at a very young stage in the business. They have probably joined taking on quite a lot of risk because, you know, if they've had a bit of experience, maybe they could have had a higher paid job elsewhere. You want to make sure that you really bottle up that kind of early stage ownership mentality and keep it flowing through the company because it will rub off on new people as well. They'll want to be part of it. It can feel a bit like culty almost in the early days where everyone's working on everything. If there's a problem, you stay in the office until you solve it. And when you have all these processes and structures, you know, this is how many days a week we want you in the office. This is our policy on that. It's important, but it can stifle a bit of that kind of early stage evangelical mentality that is really effective. But yeah, again, going back to the comment of balance, you want a bit of both. You want a bit of structure and process and a bit of that kind of naive enthusiasm that I definitely had when I started the business.
And where's it gone now?
Where's it gone? I think you treat different parts of the business with slightly different lenses. So the mature parts of our business, I have to think with a bit more structure, and the questions I ask, the way I kind of manage people within that space would be different to if we were seeding a new part of the business that is starting at zero and we needed to be hacky and experimental and fast, really fast paced, even more fast paced, and be more willing to take risk. So the sorts of people you have, the approach you have in those different parts can be different. And that's cool. That's kind of how you stay with a fresh mind within the business.
I was about to say, you have to be really dynamic and nimble as a leader to put on those different hats and those different scenarios. But that also sounds like you almost have a later stage founder persona that you have to be for the more established part of the business. Then you're kind of almost, you're building a new business within the business, and that then you put on that sort of early stage founder cap again, and you can sort of tap into that side of you. Which one feels more like you?
I think that it's the same person inside on both, because I still bring my bias towards action, my risk taking, my speed to the more mature part of the business. It's just that I understand that if you take a big risk, for example, in the more mature parts, the consequences of it going wrong are much greater. It affects far more people. And so the downside of taking risk in that world is it can really have a detrimental effect on the business. The upside of working in the more mature parts of the business is that any change you make can have a huge impact, even if it's a little one, because if you're doing conversion rate optimization on a landing page and you have millions of hits each month, you can do something that's so basic, changing the words on a button, and it can increase your revenue by tens of thousands of pounds that month. Mm. So that's cool. I do love the creative kind of starting something from nothing side. I think so many founders love that period where you feel like you're all in a room each day, not knowing what tomorrow has in store, and you're just wanting to try a bit of everything and realize this grand vision that you've set for yourself. So that is exciting. But you can foster that within a later stage company too.
What I hear is that founders are usually good, or actually leaders are usually good at different stages of the business. Mm-hmm. And often the founder that takes the company from 0 to 100 people might be different from the founder who takes it from 100 people to 1,000 people, which would be different from some person who takes it from 1,000 plus.
That's true. I think my co-founder Bertie and I take a lot of pleasure and interest in evolving with each stage. So it's almost like this competitive challenge, competitive nature in us to say, okay, we're starting a new phase of the business. Are we going to scale or are we not? And I think in each of those moments, we'll think about what sort of mentors do we need? What sort of coaching might we need? What type of leaders do we want to bring in that will help almost like help us rise up? And so obviously, 10 years ago when I started the business, I would never have been able to handle any of the stuff I handled in future years. That was not, but it does that mean that's not me? I'm not capable of it. It's more that I haven't grown into that yet. And so that's the way I see each phase. Each phase has its own interesting bits. boring bits, challenges, opportunities. And I think the intellectual process of trying to master each stage or get better at each stage, I've never mastered the stage, but get better at each stage, is almost like the funnest part of the journey. Mm. And therefore you can apply it to any stage. I'm sure if we listed on the stock exchange today, I would be an awful leader of it. Tomorrow I might be a great leader, who knows? But I think figuring out how you get there, all the chess pieces that you have to put into place, the experiences you have, the mistakes you make, are what makes the journey interesting.
So speaking of progression plans, what does your progression plan look like?
I guess there's a few things I'm quite interested in from a progression plan perspective. Probably my deepest passions lie on the kind of product and commercial side of the business. I also really, really love the kind of operating side, but I've kind of grown to love it, having not thought it was my bag early on. I'm quite a creative kind of big picture thinker. And so I think there's a few things. One thing I'm really interested in within my tutor at the moment is we're expanding our product set quite significantly. And I'm interested in how we create a product that is viral and exceptionally engaged with in a way that our current product isn't. And when I say isn't, we have an hour a week that people learn with us. They sort of love that hour, but then they don't do anything with us outside that. And so the idea of having multiple touch points in the week and learning how to craft a really amazing customer journey is a really cool part of my development. I think also the business being 10 years old, we're kind of going into that stage of thinking about what our exit plan might be, whether that's raising another big round, a strategic partnership, a full exit, we're open-minded, a listing. But I think just learning about that process and figuring out how to get the business in the right shape. I also am really interested in evolving how I become a better board member. And that's involved me taking up other board roles outside of my tutor and figuring out from different contexts how to interact and govern a business and hold the leaders accountable in the right way and support them in the right way. Those are probably three, the kind of product side, the exit planning side, and the board exploration.
And so then do you look for coaches and mentors within each of these streams?
Yeah, it would generally be different people for each goal. I have the luxury of being part of the Founders Network, which is probably the best thing I've done personally and professionally, both as a support system and then as a way of meeting people who can give me amazing advice. So that's often my first port of call when I want to speak to company who's been through X. So whether it's fundraising, hiring, big mistakes that I've made that I want to overcome.
Can you give me an example of someone you've chatted to recently?
Well, I guess a good example is Amory Hubey, who's the founder of Just Giving, has been our chair on our board for five and a bit years now. And she's awesome. She's just an amazing storyteller. And so I've learned a lot about the kind of journey side from her. And then also her experiences exiting Just Giving, dealing with investors. We've obviously been on the board together, so I've got a lot of interesting learnings of how to chair. So that would be one example. She's in the founders community. We've taken inspiration from lots of companies, whether it's your Bloom and Wilds, your Shazams, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. I've just met so many interesting people along the way that have taught me so many different things that I never, ever would have had access to. And just hearing their stories and picking the bits that resonate with you and having access to that information is incredible. So yeah, going back to an earlier point I said, when developing people, invest in your network. And it doesn't just have to be going to networking events, because I hate networking events. It's about community and giving back as well. So I make sure that I do the same with other people who are earlier in the journey, or sometimes people who are ahead of me in the journey, but I've experienced something that they just haven't. So yeah, it's a give and take.
I absolutely love that. So the journey that you have been on has been a roller coaster like most startups, specifically during COVID. Can you tell us about your COVID journey?
Lockdown came to us in March 2020. I'd just had my first child, Isla, in Feb. I was on paternity leave during that time. And I remember coming into the business to chat about what we're going to do with COVID. We knew that we were going to have to send everyone home. And we were terrified. We were worried we were going to run out of cash, had no idea what would happen with the business. So we went home. We were about 40 people in the company. And then we got a message from this kind of research organization called EEF, who had done a lot of work in the education space, sort of proving the impact of different companies. And they said, look, we're very interested in piloting a tutoring program to see if it's a good solution to these COVID lockdowns. And we did a pilot. We were the lead partner on a pilot, one of three or four companies. We helped 2,000 students and it went amazingly well. And the government responded by putting in place a £1 billion policy that meant that every student could have access to exactly what we did. And we applied to a tender, we became the lead partner, we were given the largest allocation of any company. And we just knew, we were looking at each other and we were like, wow, we've got to scale up fast. This is big.
And do you mind me asking how much of the tender you got?
In the first year, we got a license to help 30,000 kids. You know, it would have doubled our business overnight more. And particularly in the B2B space, would have kind of multiplied it by 5x. So we were very excited and nervous, but really had to run at the problem. And we had to hire a lot of people. So we went from, in the space of 18 months, 40 people to about 300, just under 300. So we had to learn about how to hire fast. We had to learn about how to bring together a culture and evolve our culture in a remote setup. We had a mix of amazing successes, some months where we were doing like 10x the year before. And then we had some dramatic failures. We had months where I remember a moment where we said, there are too many customers calling in about problems. And my customer operations director said, we should turn off the phone lines. And I said, you can't turn off the phone lines. We have to speak to them. But it was one of those moments where we just didn't know what to do because we just had so much traction, which was amazing. And we raised a big investment round off of it. We hired loads of new leaders, some of whom have been amazing for us and are still with us today. We had a particular tragedy in the business where our biggest team that we were scaling up was our customer service team. And we brought in a head of ops near the beginning of COVID, sort of a few months in to help us with that transition. We did all the interviews online and we brought him into our leadership team. And then about 9 months in, having never met him, he called me up and he said, I'm not very well. I'm not going to be in for the next couple of days. I've got the flu. And we thought nothing of it. We just said, hope you get better soon. Look after yourself. And then got more texts and each one became worse and worse where he said, actually, I'm going to have some tests today because I can't figure out what's going wrong, but I'm feeling worse and worse. And then he said, I'm being put into intensive care. And then the next message was from his girlfriend saying he's not going to make it. He's got cancer. And he died within 2 weeks of saying he felt unwell. So it was just one of the toughest moments of the time at my tutor. It was incredibly difficult for the team, people who were going through COVID at the same time and probably dealing with their own mental, well, definitely dealing with their own mental health challenges. I was a new dad and it hit home for me because I had to ring all of his direct reports and wider team one-to-one and tell them what had happened. And people were in disbelief. We tried to figure out how to speak to his family and support them. But it was so bizarre because we'd never met this person in person. And he was such a big part of our leadership team. Speak to each other every day on video, did all these team bonding events. And then this person was gone. So at a time where we were scaling up the fastest, probably the worst moment of the journey happened as well.
Wow. And something you never expect or can prepare for when running a company, right? Like, how often does that ever happen?
Yeah, I mean, I know that other people will have gone through similar things. At the time, you sort of, there's no playbook for it. You can't ask people how to deal with that sort of thing. So you just have to use your intuition and take advice from people in your team about how they want to be treated, And yeah, I feel proud of how we came together in that moment. We definitely, I don't have any regrets about how we handled it. It was just sad and bizarre. But, you know, you have to be prepared to deal with anything as a business. So we did. And we carried on scaling and we found new leaders and we remembered and memorialized him. And yeah, and that's how we pushed through.
Sounds like you did loads. And I think you should be very proud of that. So that's amazing. Going back to the scaling journey, going from 40 to 300 people will lead to lots of things breaking, lots of growing pains. Can you speak to that journey and how do you scale a people operations within the business?
When we started out, one of the things we were renowned for was our customer service. We were exceptionally responsive and supportive, particularly on our kind of school side where we were dealing with big classes who are using one-to-one tutoring at a time where online tutoring was really new, so riddled with challenges and complexity. When COVID happened and we were scaling, some of that quality dropped and some of our processes broke. We had unstable tech that was going down in the middle of peak periods. We had more customer service tickets at times than we could solve. We had to radically evolve our kind of automations on the platform to make sure that we wouldn't have to just hire hundreds and hundreds of people in order to kind of solve basic issues. And we were doing that at a time where we were trying to make sure that we had the working capital to invest in scale. So we were fundraising. We were dealing with kind of churn of customers who weren't getting the experience that we were used to giving. And so those sorts of issues, I think they're both the toughest moments in the business, but they're also the times where you prove your mettle as a team and you really grow together. And I remember, for example, a couple of times where we had these major site outages at peak moments. Our customers were feeling really let down. And I just saw leaders almost take their moment to shine and turn things around for us as a team. There was one moment where my co-founders and I were out the office at a pitch and we knew that this thing was going on and we felt awful that we couldn't be with the team. And we came back and they'd sorted it. And it was one of those moments where we thought, okay, we've got a company. This is a company. Because before we would have felt like the parents doing all the kind of hard stuff. But we realized that, okay, we can go on holiday for a week and feel like the company's not going to burn down. But yeah, I think the moments that hurt the most relate to people. So when you upset customers, when you have to make difficult decisions internally, when people don't work out or you don't give them exactly what they need and want. And during COVID, those initial months, there were some really beautiful moments because it was so exciting and exhilarating, scaling so fast. And then some shit hit the fan moments where we were just like, are we going to lose the whole business because we can't handle the scale? Like, are we going to run out of supply on our marketplace in terms of the tutors? Are we going to churn through all of our B2B contracts? Are we going to have the working capital to pay the bills in a few months' time? Those sorts of problems that every startup goes through, we definitely experience intensely during that scale-up phase.
Can you share a single shit hit the fan story or moment?
I can share something from the early stages. Because the two shit the fan moments that I can think of were the platform down and the death of the head of ops. Those are probably the two that resonate most. Yeah. In the early stage, there were quite a few. So my tutor has always been an online tutoring company, and early on, probably the biggest problem we had was convincing people to try online when they wanted to have a tutor in person. So we very early on had a customer who'd booked in a free meeting. We offer free meetings online, and they found their tutor, got really excited, booked it for her daughter. Then we realized that the daughter hadn't turned up for the free meeting, got a call the next day. And it was the mum who was absolutely furious with us, just like, I can't believe you. I went out and I bought breakfast. I put on a great spread for the tutor and they just didn't show up. And we were like, you do know it's online tutoring, right? And yeah, we realized that maybe we weren't signposting it well enough.
That is hilarious. I'd love to go down this path that you sort of alluded to, which is having this solid leadership team in place that means that you can take a week's holiday or you can step away from the business and there can be a fire going on and you can trust that they're going to put it out. And I know that you invest heavily in your leadership team and their development and like sort of team building and nurturing. Can you speak to how you approach that?
We've invested really heavily in our leadership team and the culture that we foster and the way we're kind of making decisions as a group. We do quarterly offsites is one ritual alongside our weekly leadership meetings. And within those leadership offsites, we have a core leadership group, which is the C-level, an executive team. And then we have an extended leadership team. And so we have different rituals for each of those groups. One of the things that we found exceptionally useful as a tool is we read a book called Five Dysfunctions of a Team. It's basically a guide of how you have a successful high-performance team that trusts each other and are committed to the decisions that you're making. We use this book, Five Dysfunctions of a Team, whenever we're doing our quarterly offsite sessions to check the health of our team and then use it as a basis to figure out where we should improve. So the pillars are building trust, resolving conflict, committing as a team, holding each other accountable, and then focusing on results. So if you think about the pyramid, no team is going to succeed without trust, that foundational layer on the first tier. And then if you have trust, you can commit to things together and know that you're all committed and you're not going to stab each other in the back. You can then use that as a platform to resolve any conflicts, hold each other accountable against what you've committed to, and then focus on the results and just make sure you keep coming back to what you wanted to do. So for us, we do a survey that takes about 10 minutes that involves basically figuring out which of those pillars we're doing well on and badly on. If you're doing badly on trust, that's a big problem. And we score highly on trust generally. Like, there's the occasional blip where it goes slightly backwards and then it sort of goes straight back up. But if you're communicating well, you should have trust. But we basically use this survey to identify, okay, here's two themes that we should go through. Like our attention to results, for example, this quarter have not been as good as it could have been. Why is that? What are people's experiences? And then what do we want to do together as a team to make that better the next quarter? So that's an example of a ritual that we have that we use quite religiously. And then I suppose another tool that we use at the offsites is starting with an exercise that creates vulnerability. And I know this is something you care about. So we have, for example, done sessions where we say, right, let's spend 10 minutes talking about your life story at the beginning of a session. And it immediately puts you in the mind frame of, I'm going to be open with my feelings and thoughts about this thing. I'm going to share any baggage that I bring to the table on this session. And in these offsites, we tend to go away. So we don't just book a WeWork in London. We go somewhere in the countryside or even in another country sometimes. And we just take time, we rent a house, we stay together and we eat together, form these bonds, but also talk about strategy and direction and dysfunctions. So those have been really effective for us because it's very different from our day-to-day leadership team meetings.
How do you respond to some people not wanting to merge this sort of personal professional life? Like some people are say, oh, I don't want to pour my heart out and be as vulnerable maybe as you're expecting me to be.
I think people do have different levels of vulnerability. We have tended to hire people who are relatively high on the vulnerability scale, but like it's a work in progress because firstly, you could in a different setting not want to be vulnerable at all, even if you're normally really vulnerable. So I might in another company, depending on the culture, clam up. I might not trust people with my feelings and emotions to say I'm having a bad time at the moment or whatever. And we've had people who've come from those contexts and it takes some time to unwind and sort of, I think it's leading by example. So if they see you do it, they're more likely to do it. And also knowing they don't have to tell you everything. Yeah. You know, there are some things that can be kept off the table. My experience is that most things, if you give the right environment, are on the table.
Yeah, I completely agree. That's very much the approach I took with founders. If you lead with vulnerability and you almost de-risk it for them,
yeah.
If you're saying like, we're all going to do it. And so therefore, like, it's not just one person with the spotlight on them.
Yeah. I have the luxury of having lots of embarrassing things to share. And so I can be super vulnerable and even take being teased about it. And I think hopefully that's infectious for other people.
Love that. Okay. Wow. The last thing before we go on to you more as an individual is your relationship with your co-founders. You started a company before, Tutor Tap, and then it merged into My Tutor. And so then you have two leadership teams which are essentially merging, which is really tricky because most people spend a long time choosing their co-founders and building that trust and that relationship. How was the experience for you?
Well, from a leadership team perspective, it was just me because the businesses were so, so young, nearly no revenue between us. There are three of us, three co-founders, two still in the business, myself and my co-founder, Bertie. In a great way, we were all really different skill sets. Bertie and I have different ways of thinking and have different ways of being creative or problem solving. And so I found one of the kind of best things about My Tutor, Bertie and I learning how to be more than 1 + 1 = 2. So being more than the sum of our parts. And that's involved a lot of communication, a lot of work together to understand what triggers us, where are our anxieties in the business, what are our aspirations for it. So we've spent a lot of deep work time figuring out just how to work with each other, because you go through so many stressful moments and you can be each other's best friend or worst enemy depending on how you behave. And there's a lot of respect between us to figure out the best way to manage each other, manage ourselves. One thing that was challenging in the beginning is the three co-founders had relatively different goals for what the business would end up being. So for example, one of my co-founders was near retirement and was really keen for an earlier exit in terms of, you know, selling his shares and being able to retire. And then Bertie, for example, has an extremely long-term minded approach. So was thinking about what could be built over decades and a lot of patience within it. And then I'm somewhere in between. So I care about the big vision a lot and I've done 10 years. So hopefully that evidences it. I'm really excited to start other businesses in my entrepreneurial career. And so I have lots of areas of interest. Education is one of them and technology. And so the lesson there is, in Bertie, in my case, it's worked. It's really important to figure out exactly what you want from a business with your co-founders beforehand, what a good end result looks like, how you might work together, and really invest in that upfront before you are married to each other, essentially. Because for co-founder relationships, you're always a co-founder in your business, whether you're in it or out of it. And so it's important with those relationships. I'm grateful that Bertie and I have really like intentionally invested in our own ways of working with each other, whilst having really different skill sets that you essentially need in a business.
What does that intentional deep work look like?
A mixture of different spaces. So you have your regular one-to-ones. We like to have longer form kind of afternoons together in a different space, kind of like mini versions of our offsites. So for example, when we were launching in the US last year, we did a lot of travel to the US and we would, you know, share Airbnbs, have like sort of the weekends together. And that's where you start talking about some of the longer term. So I think it's important to balance having the opportunity to talk about the business today and then where you see it going and staying aligned there. Because if you leave it half a year, you can end up so far apart that it influences exactly the decisions you're making today. And that can really creep up on you. And you end up sort of giving people in the company very different messages if you've got multiple leaders doing that. Another ritual was over time, we had to keep redefining our relationship with each other, both in terms of the roles and responsibilities within the company. And then also just like some of the performance management, because you don't have a right to be in the company, even if you're the founder of it. You need to add value to it and you need to evolve with it. Even if it's your baby and you feel like it's your baby, you're not just there to observe the journey. You're there to lead and you're there to make good decisions. So setting the kind of ground rules around that relationship and making sure that you each have a bit of accountability towards each other, when sometimes if you don't have that, you won't get it anywhere and you won't be given feedback or held to account.
Have you done any structured work, like any coaching or facilitated experiences or following worksheets or anything like that?
We both get coaching, so we both have performance coaching. One of the things that Bertie does each year with his coach, and I don't actually do this with my coach, but I'd love to, each year his coach has phone calls with all of his colleagues in the senior leadership team and ask questions about, you know, his strengths, his weaknesses, and he produces a full report, a really long report, that Bertie then shares with the leadership team and our board, and which is a really good, vulnerable place to be and shows a lot of openness to improve. But I really like that methodology where you're, as a leader, it's so easy to not solicit feedback. If you're not intentional about it, you can live in a vacuum where you have no idea what people think of you and feel. And that's quite terrifying to me. Like if I never asked anyone how I can get better and kind of live in that world, just like the thought that people could be fostering, you know, negativity or be frustrated with the way I behave or see me as stagnant and not improving. I think just constantly asking for feedback and really thanking people for giving it to you, making them feel safe.
Very strong. It sounds like a very healthy working relationship. That's impressive. I'd love to spend the last sort of 10 minutes talking more about you and life outside of My Tutor and the intense startup journey. But there's also an intense parenthood journey that you're on and have been going through since COVID as well. Isla is your oldest one. She's 4. And then your youngest is called what, sorry?
Henry.
Henry.
Yeah.
Henry. Amazing. How has the step into parenthood been?
The step into parenthood has been exactly what I always wanted, but also incredibly difficult. So I adore my kids. I have so much love and gratitude for having, you know, the opportunity to raise them. Obviously it comes with all the anxiety, the parental anxieties of, are you doing a good job and giving them what they need?
How do you do your performance management as a parent?
Yeah, I would say it's a work in progress because there's definitely reflection that my wife and I do, you know, periodically around what can we improve, are our ways of working right? But I think I sometimes avoid running it as I would run my business and have a slightly more gung-ho approach of just trying to be calm and know that not everything is going to be perfect, but they'll be okay, and being supportive and nurturing, give them new experiences and fun. I think I'm quite a playful dad. So the sort of persona I have at home is silly, goofy, you know, dancing with the kids, singing to the Lion King, games in the garden, rolling in the mud, laughing a lot. So, you know, I think giving kids that is important. I read somewhere that a dad's role is around sort of figuring out boundaries around like play. So the mother in the early years is more of a nurturing force for the kid, and the father is the, I don't know, I mean, you could probably read another book that has the exact opposite. But anyway, I take a very playful role. I'm silly, I'm goofy. I would say I'm quite silly and goofy at work as well, though. So I probably, thinking about it, have a closer persona than I maybe had been assuming.
Love that. And the challenge that all parents face, but then especially founder parents, is this notion of balance. But balance is such a vague and broad word, and I think people define it differently. So therefore, how do you define balance?
How do I define balance?
Or maybe what is balance? What does it feel like to you?
Well, balance at the moment feels a bit unachievable. But I do my best, and there are certain things that do help. I think one of the components of balance is acceptance, that there are times where you're just not going to have it. And I really struggle with that, to be honest, because as a founder, I sort of optimize constantly. I A-B test, I experiment, and I'm like, there is an answer, there's a solution. But I do think with certain things, you need to accept that this is going to be messy. And there are going to be times where you have your perfect routine and it's just broken because your kid's unwell, needs to be picked up from nursery, and your wife's on a business call. And that is just like the expectation management of sometimes you're not going to be able to do all the things that make you feel good. And in those moments, you need to accept it and try not to let it hurt your day. But I then do have some tactics that I use. So an example of a tactic is thinking about what is the most important thing for me personally. So not necessarily, I'm not including working or parenting. I'm saying what makes me feel good that is going to be a non-negotiable in my life. And for me, that's the gym. So I block out the calendar where I go to the gym and I will go to the sauna because it's my happy place. I love the sauna. And I will make space for that. Maybe I'll answer some emails while I'm there. Who knows? But it's kind of like... Not in the sauna. The sauna is a quiet space, but in the gym. But yeah, I really make it a priority. So I go to the gym. I will be in the gym 3 times a week at least, maybe up to 5. But there are those 3 ring fence slots that my team cannot book over. So they can't put calendar slots in on top of that. And I've blocked out a proper amount of time that I know I will do and I can do. And so I've always found that anything that I intentionally make my top priority, I do. Anything that's second or third can quite easily slip. Sure. And so once you've built in that good routine on number one, then move on to number two and set yourself like small goals that are easy. I guess this is all in all the habit checking books, like always. Start off small, yeah. Set intentions, build the right environment where it's going to happen. So in the case of gym, is the gym nearby? Have I got the right sort of transport that means that I'm going to do it no matter what? Yeah. So my moped. Have I got an environment in the gym that is going to be really good for me? Like, am I going to be able to do the right exercises that make my body feel good? Do I have, for me, you know, the sauna has to be one that I can lie down in because I like lying down with my earphones in and meditating. So like those sorts of things are really core for my balance, because when you have your business, you go into the office, 100 people want to speak to you about that their thing that they're working on, or feedback they need, or a blocker they need unblocking. And when you go home, your kids obviously are kids, you know, they need you at any given moment. And so for me, it's having a space that I know I'm not going to be interrupted. I go to the gym, I'm super antisocial, have my big block headphones on, and then in the sauna, have my quiet time. And you know, it's simple pleasures, but I know that no matter how bad a week I'm having, I have those moments that I can decompress.
How do you how does Talia like cope with being married to such a stud? He's obviously ripped in the gym all the time.
By the way, it's Talia.
Talia.
Yeah.
Talia.
Okay. Yeah.
Talia. And how are you and Talia as a team?
So Talia and I spend a lot of time thinking about how we want to parent. And I think for me, it's a good combination between doing things separately so the other person has space with the kids. So for example, on the weekends, you know, taking them to swimming lessons or to the park so that we each have our ring fence moments to decompress, but then also making sure that we're doing family outings. I mean, my most fun moments as a family are dinner time where the kids are throwing food at us and we're in the kitchen and we put on some music and we dance. So we at least a few times a week, we'll just be dancing in the kitchen. And in those moments, you just feel really present. You're laughing, and it makes kind of all the pain when the kids are screaming because they don't want to go in the bath a bit more bearable. I also love story time. So story time as a family is the cutest. Henry's just starting to speak and he can't say anything properly, but it's hilarious whatever comes out of his mouth. And watching Isla be a good big sister. So kind of those family moments I really treasure. And you can have them, particularly because I work from home a couple of times a week. And so those are ring fence times to do the nighttime routine. What we're trying to get better at is the date nights. We do them, but not often enough. And whenever we do, we have a great time. So yeah. So building space there. What we did do in August was, so we met 15 and a half years ago in Zante, which was the first holiday, the trashy holiday away from your family for the first time. We met in a club on the first night and they said it was a holiday romance, but we ended up together. So we did a reunion tour 15 years later. We took a few days away from the kids and went to a hotel in Zante, slightly away from the trashy strip, but we went back to the strip and yeah. Wow. Yeah. It was very fun.
And that's a perfect way to close it off, is that I had a lovely conversation with Talia, and she said incredible things about you. Would you like to watch them?
Oh, yeah.
You've said how you really admire his work ethic, and you've known him since you were 17, which is a long time. What else do you really deeply admire about him?
I think I really admire his openness. He's very honest with everyone and very like down to earth with everyone. He really doesn't he's got no ego. He does. I take that back. No, he's not. I think I really respect how open he is. I think men in general struggle with their emotions, and he is very in tune with his, and he's very articulate about the way he's feeling, and also like he's very relatable. I think he really wears his heart on his sleeve.
Last question. What is James like as a father?
He's an incredible father. Incredible. He is very, very patient. He is... he loves to teach our kids things. And, you know, he takes Isla swimming every week. And he is just very doting and just adores them. And is kind of... in awe of them. It's very sweet. Makes me love him so much more, which is crazy.
With the knowledge that I'm showing this to him, is there anything else that you say about him?
Just that I adore you and love you, and I've loved you since I was 17, and I will always love you.
Very cute.
So cute, right?
Yeah.
So cute.
Thank you for that.
You are welcome. Well, thank you for coming. This has been amazing. You are such a wealth of knowledge, and you have such energy and enthusiasm for the business and also sharing what you've learned. And I have enjoyed being a sponge to everything you said.
Thank you. Well, I hope it's useful for people. I also really loved your touches. So classical music when I arrived, the cocktail, the healthy snacks. Oh, you know, really, really well curated. And yeah, I'm rooting for this to take off.
Thank you. Me too.